Good afternoon. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer emeritus from York College, City University of New York, welcoming you to this November 28th post-Black Thanks edition of Vantage Point here on 99.5 FM. That's WBAI on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with ycradio.org. That's right. The York College radio community, where I used to teach and enjoy doing so, is plugged in to our conversation, expanding the audience, which, of course, is not only local, it is U.S.-based and global. We get comments and from around the globe, but particularly from the Caribbean, as people plug in and listen to our show. Well, today, we want to have a special conversation. We've not yet here on this on the Vantage Point unpacked the election, and that's because immediately after the election, I traveled to Colombia in South America, particularly to Bogota, to attend a international workshop on reparations. And I had a special mission also to meet the new Afro-descended woman vice president, the first in the history of Colombia, the Honorable Gracia Marquez, who is the new president of Francia. I'm sorry, Francia Marquez, the new Afro-descended president of Colombia. Well, today we're going to have our dream team be with us shortly, and that dream team, of course, is none other than Earl Ofari Hutchinson, who is, of course, a radio personality and leader for many, many years. Author, prolific author. He's with our sister station in Los Angeles. And, of course, Bill Fletcher, who also previously had a show on WPFW in Washington. By the social justice and labor activists and much, much more to deal with the topic, MAGAism. That's right, MAGAism checked but not defeated, the way forward. And we're going to have that conversation. And then we're going to spend time, some of you heard, and we're the National Town Hall meeting broadcast on WBAI and also WPFW for that matter. Or some of you may have viewed it on the IBW website or other platforms. Well, you heard me talk about All Roads Lead to Baltimore for State of the Black World Conference number 5. And so I'm going to take some time at the end of the show to give you kind of a comprehensive overview of State of the Black World Conference 5, which is slated for April of 2023. You say, well, how so soon? Because we have to prepare now, begin to organize now. And, of course, we anticipate, certainly are eager to have a partnership, a media partnership with both WPFW as well as WBAI, as we did in 2016. That's right, it's been 2016 since the last State of the Black World Conference, which was an amazing conference in Newark, New Jersey, hosted by the Honorable Roz J. Baraka. So we'll come back and talk to you about that in detail, because I got to tell you, tell no lies, claim no easy victories. We need your help. We need your ability to organize, galvanize, educate, all of those things in order to have a successful State of the Black World Conference by it. Well, my dream team is with us, and I want to welcome them to the show. Earl Ofari Hutchinson, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. How are you, Ron?
I'm doing fine. Dr. Not as good Daniels. As you. I was looking at one of your promos today about your authorship of so many books, and the Lord have mercy, you have a whole library of books. So I just want to grow up and be like you, my brother.
No, I think, you know, we're on the same plane. No change.
Yeah, right. Well, and Bill Fletcher. Well, Bill has published a few books as well. Bill Fletcher, you there?
I'm here. Greetings.
All right,
to both of you.
Okay, well, look, as I said before in my introduction, we haven't had a chance to talk about the election because we had the National Town Hall meeting, which was an incredible success. But then I was off to Colombia on a mission, and then I got back and did a special show on Haiti in collaboration with the Battle of Voltaires and the crisis in Haiti today, which we wanted to address. So this is really our first opportunity to talk about the election. And again, our topic is MAGAism. That is Make America Great. That is associated with the Orange Man, a.k.a. Agent Orange, as I call him. MAGAism, check, not defeated. The way forward is what we want to discuss. Ultimately, get your perspectives on what happened. But I want to just, first of all, go to each of you, starting with you, Earl, with as we look back at the election, the question is, this give your just your initial assessment. I'm sure you've been doing interviews and not being asked your opinion. Just a synopsis of your assessment of the outcome of the midterm elections.
Well, it was a mixed bag, but I think on balance, slightly favorable mixed bag. Let's take the Senate. I was not surprised. I did expect Democrats to pretty much hold their own in the Senate. We still have, of course, coming up December 6th, Georgia. I think that's going to be a critical. Many people kind of downplay that. I don't. I think it's extremely critical for another reason. Even though it's true, the Democrats do hold the Senate at this point. The fact is, we do need Warnock. We do need him to win. We need him for another reason. Not just to tip the Senate, it's already there. What we need is Manchin. We need Manchin to neutralize him. We can't have another 2 years of Manchin controlling everything. All the conservative stuff, all the checks, you know, all the limitations he puts on anything, I mean anything that even remotely smacks the progressive legislation, Manchin is right there to kill it. Republican light. So we need Warnock, we need him to win to neutralize that. The House, not surprised. Small majority. My thinking about the House of Bill and Ron is this. You need fighting Democrats. Pelosi stepping down. She served her time. She did well in her day. But time has moved on. You need new leadership. You need new energy. You need new perspectives on that. But most importantly, you need fighting Democrats. I think we've got some of them in there now that are willing to go Harry Truman. And when I say Harry Truman, what Truman did in 1948, he went after Congress. It was a Republican-controlled Congress. He beat up on them from one end of the country to another, called them a do-nothing, sit-on-their-butt Congress, and he revved up people, and it worked. Democrats got to do the same with the House. All they're going to do with these stupid little, dumb little investigations, wasting our time, taxpayer money, obstructing everything, hopefully they will look dumb and stupid like they are, and enough people will get that. Locally, we did fairly well. We had a mayoral election in Los Angeles.
Oh, yes.
We made history. Karen Bass, former chair of the Congressional Black Caucus for a time, longtime member of Congress. Karen, she won the mayorship, the first African-American female to win the mayorship in, you know, Los Angeles. But in addition to that, all the votes are in now, and it looks like it's a landslide. So Karen's a very pragmatic progressive, good people, and I think, you know, we can make some progress there. So overall, my assessment is a lot of work to be done, 2 years, a lot of challenges, a lot of things on tap. Progressives have their work cut out for them. Democrats definitely have their work cut out for them, but I think on balance, it could have been a lot worse. Thank God it wasn't.
Well, we're going to come to that last part in more detail in terms of the future of the progressive movement and the Democrats and where black voters stand in that process as we move forward. We really want to focus on that. But I just wanted to get your initial take. So, Bill, your initial take. I'm sure you've had to provide a lot of analysis in your interviews with various media outlets and inquiries that have come to you as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, as usual, I agree with Earl. And all I would add to what you raised, Earl, is that, one, we dodged a bullet. That's the way I look at it. But the bullets are still coming at us. It was from a 50 caliber machine gun. So it's not like anyone should rest easy at all. The second thing is about polls. There's a discussion that I think we really need to have about polls. You know, when you think about what was happening prior to the election, there was a drumbeat about this so-called Republican wave. I won't call it a red wave because I know who the Reds are, and these folks aren't Reds. But in any case, this Republican wave, right, that people were talking about, and it didn't happen. And while the Republicans ended up looking silly, what I'm more concerned about is that in 2020, there was supposed to be a blue wave. That didn't happen. And so there's something in the way that polling is being done or whatever that really needs to be identified. And I think that one lesson for me coming out of this is to not rely on the polls, to not let people become demoralized by polls. And the best thing is for internal, scientifically done, objective polls for campaigns so that the campaigns can plot out their strategy. But what was happening this time, it appears, is that the Republicans, as a matter of tactics, decided to conduct their own polls with small samples and flood the media with the results, leading many of the mainstream media to come to all the wrong conclusions. And I think that there's some lessons there.
Well, Bill, you really anticipated my second question because, and I'll use the vernacular because I will say, why were the predictions of the red wave, we'll call it the Republican wave, so far off? And so I'll toss that to Earl as well.
And you know, Ron and Bill, I'm glad you brought that up about the polls. I'm glad you brought it up for another reason. First of all, you're right. But I think there's a little bit more. Let's go a little bit further with this. Again, maybe I'm being a little overly paranoid. Maybe I'm being even a little conspiratorial. And I hate to go there with that. That's not me. But I have seen almost from the moment, going back in time, even before, even when Trump announced he's going to run, I've seen a decided, I'm a very close media watcher, mainstream media, a tilt for the Republican Party, the GOP. It's almost like it's a Trump media. Everything the guy did, said, every stupidity out there, we got to be bombarded with that 24 hours on the news cycle. You know, it became a Trump media. It almost became a GOP media. Now we come to this so-called red wave. I began to notice almost the day after Biden took office, the drumbeat was, Republicans are going to win the midterms. Republicans are going to do this. Republicans are going to, even before the polls came in, going back, suggesting, well, always the party in power, the president's party. They always lose in midterms, which is not true. But that was the narrative. Early on, even before the polls, Bill, the media began framing a narrative very clearly that the GOP is going to win. So it's almost like they're telling people, stay home. What's the point? Game is already over. You know, before the whistle even blew to start the game, I began seeing that, and I have to tell you, I was deeply troubled by that. Because if, in fact, you're letting the media guide you on this, propagandizing for the GOP, then essentially you're damping down the vote, Democratic vote, progressive vote. And that was the thing that I was deeply concerned about. And quite frankly, I don't see that going away. It's going to be there going all the way through 2023 up to the presidential election of 2024.
I'm so glad that you raised this, Earl, because I was feeling exactly the same way. I mean, exactly. Right after 2020, I was absolutely amazed at how quickly the media flipped into this, the Democrats are going to lose in 2022. And I'm just saying, my God, it's 2 years away in a completely unusual political situation, yet they're jumping in on this, and it is very demoralizing. I'm really glad that you raised that.
Yeah, well, let me jump in, too, because I think there's certain operative terms, and I think, Bill, you just hit on it. Because, quite frankly, there is history has been defied a couple of times. Obama did it once, and I had a reason why I thought he defied it, and I was concerned about Democratic messaging because I happen to believe that you could defy it. But the operative term was unusual circumstances. We've never, ever seen anything like this in the history of the United States, at least in recent history, the uprising of white nationalism, COVID environment, the whole election deniers and the assault on the Capitol. I mean, these were unusual circumstances, not a normal election. So for me, the question was how the Democrats would in fact message in this environment in a way that would overcome that which overcome conventional wisdom, and that is that the Dems would. I never really thought they would lose the Senate. I always thought there was a good chance to hang on there, but it looked like it could potentially be a bloodbath, no pun intended, in relationship to the House. The other thing, a couple of other points I'd like to throw in, is then this is tricky, because when you say approval, like some of this was tagged to the President Biden's approval ratings. What I recall going back in terms of the approval ratings of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, and what people soon discovered is that it had the approval ratings were very low, but for some people it was very low, not because we didn't like Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, is we wanted more. So the interpretation of being a negative or being against it was really incorrect. And I think this may have been played a role, too, in terms of Biden's approval ratings. So I think there may have been people like myself who may have, I would not have necessarily done it, but others who are saying, well, I think he can do more for black people. So therefore, I disapprove. But at the end of the day, people like that were not going to not vote for Biden because they clearly, well, we think maybe clearly understood the differences that were what was at stake. The other thing is sampling. I mean, I don't think folk, you know, like a lot of people say, when's the last time you received a call or anything in terms of these polls? And a lot of black folks don't get them. But particularly when you're talking about younger voters and voters with from particular constituencies, you know, the degree that you would have sampled them, because there was a surprising, to some people, a surprising turnout of young voters, you know, in this election. My final point is, you know, it was interesting because I was looking at some of the what I would call more credible polls, like, you know, CNN, New York Times and whatever. And at the end, they were actually showing that the generic preference in Congress was close and actually had flipped towards the Democrats. But even though that was right in front of people's faces, the commentators kept, you know, talking about the red wave. So right. It was really, really, really a very intriguing scenario. And, you know, I'm with you. I'm glad it turned out the way it turned out, because, again, it was what I call MAGAism checked, but not defeated. But let me quickly just go to a couple of other issues here before we talk more about the future. And I'm wondering, from your perspectives, both Earl and Bill, what were or do you believe to be the most important issues in terms of both Democratic turnout in general, but also black voters in particular, because it appears that black voters, you know, once again came to the rescue, even though at the end of the day, there was a dip. It was not like an overwhelming turnout. I mean, there was some, it was not the same as I guess it was 2018 or whatnot, but nonetheless, it was sufficient to help carry the day. But I'm just interested in your thoughts, because there was all kind of discussion about, was it abortion? Was it the economy? Was maybe sleepy Joe Biden right in saying the danger to democracy was something that people actually grabbed a hold to and moved? So again, Earl and Bill, your perspectives.
Well, I think all of the above. I think obviously abortion, I think that grabbed a lot of people, and rightly so, the attack on that. I think the other thing, too, Ron, you just mentioned about Biden, he came in at the right time. Good timing on that. Pounded away. Do you want everything taken away? The great fear, the great threat, the great danger that the GOP, really not the GOP, you're talking about the quasi-fascist party, masquerading as a Republican party. Do you want them to take away everything, abortion on down, your freedoms, liberties, civil rights, you name it, environment, labor, all of that? I think the other thing, too, fear. I think a number of African Americans really, really have ingrained this fear of the GOP. It's a quasi-fascist party. I think many, many people got that now. It would be pretty hard not to get it. I mean, after what we've seen, you know, the last 4 or 5 years. So So I think a number of people now are motivated in that sense. And also I think something, too, I think we need to give a little credit to a lot of local Democratic candidates, many of them office holders, incumbents, and also those that are seeking office. They did message correctly. They did understand about abortion, democracy, jobs, the good job that basically Biden did in terms of some quite significant legislation that, of course, the media didn't want to really talk about and give him any credit for. But local Democrats in many areas, they did do that, and they did talk about that. Did a pretty good job, too, of mobilizing the base in many areas. So I think there's a good template there going forward as we prepare 2023, leading up to the big show in 2024. So I think there's some things to really, you know, tie our coattails to going forward.
Abiel?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And just focusing on a couple things here. One is that there were progressive candidates like Fetterman in Pennsylvania and others at the more local level who took unorthodox and aggressive stands, and I mean in the best way, in fighting back. And I think that people get really jazzed when you actually are supporting a fighter as opposed to supporting a chump. So that's one thing. The other thing is about abortion. Now, this is something that I found fascinating, that leading up to the election, this is what I kept hearing on the radio. Abortion has peaked as an issue. And there's fear that too much time has been spent by Democrats talking about abortion and not enough on other issues, blah, 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 blah. The election takes place, and it becomes clear abortion hadn't peaked. And so I think that that says a few things to me. One is what a lot of the mainstream people like to call cultural wars. I call them wars about democracy, are as central as fights around economic issues, that people are concerned about the threat to democracy. And so as Earl said, it's like a number of these issues together, not one by itself, but you bring that collection together and you arrive at critical mass.
All right. Well, a lot said, and I happen to think that, all of us were saying, frankly, we don't care what Biden says, whether the message is what we think it is or not. We know what the message ought to be. And it's like I was saying over and over again, it may have been Bernard Jordan who said, when white America gets a cold, black America gets pneumonia, we were going damn near going to be on life support. If the so-called red wave had really materialized. So folks were on the ground doing the work. I mean, they were doing it. And that was one of the critiques, by the way, all those ads. If you look at what Fetterman did old-fashioned, I'm going to every county. I don't care red, blue, green. I don't give a damn what it is. I'm going. I'm touching some people. And
there you
go. He did. He went everywhere. And there are a number of other candidates. And certainly, you know, Black Lives Matter, Voter Fund. And there's a whole bunch of Barbara Arnwine and Melanie Campbell. And so many groups, man. They just rolled up and passed the mic. They rolled up their sleeves. And they went in there and said, we don't care what the deal is. We are going to turn these voters out. And I think there was a great job done in that regard. So
and
the bottom line is,
Ron, we should add thanks to the Union Unite here.
Yes.
That
uh-huh.
did a tremendous job, particularly in Nevada and Arizona. And they've deployed people to go to Georgia now. And I just think we should also give them a lot of credit.
Yes. Well, I'm glad they're going to Georgia, because I remember back in the day, you know, you remember these kinds of elections, man, people would be packing up, going and staying in people's homes. There would be floods of people, and students in particular would be going by the hundreds to states where there was opportunities to do what needs to be done in Georgia, which really brings us to, you know, our thoughts about dodging the bullet, thanking God that it didn't happen to be worse. I, again, said we checked MAGAism, and I use that word advisedly, because it is a danger. And I'm hoping, as you said, Earl, more and more black people are understanding how dangerous this is. And so, again, I would now like us to just talk more specifically, and you already began to talk about some of the things that need to be done in terms of the Democratic Party and progressives moving forward. You've already intimated where your head is, and I certainly don't disagree, because I was using the Truman analogy too. I was talking about trying to get some spite up in here. But go ahead, you take it off.
Well, you know, just a final thought on Georgia. Georgia, coming full circle, it is important. You know, Bill and Ron, if you went to the moon, no, if you went to Mars, you couldn't find a worse candidate ever invented than a Herschel Walker. You couldn't make this up. You couldn't dream this up if you spent a million years trying. Yet and still, and this is why the wolf is still at the door, the fact is, here's a guy that has no business being anywhere, but the fact is, could actually win. I don't think he will, but close enough. That tells me one thing. We got a real problem in America. You got those deep divisions there, that the hatred, the division, the animosity is so deep. That's going to be the challenge for, real challenge for progressives and Democrats, trying to peel off some of that hatred that's so deep there that you can prop up a Herschel Walker beyond a joke and make something credible out of that. We're going to see a lot of that, by the way, in 2023, going into 2024. We have to be on guard against that and continue to do our job the way you mentioned, Bill, with the unions, the organizing, the calling. I'm doing one thing. When I get off the phone, I'm sending another check to Georgia, to the Warner campaign, and I'm urging everybody, get on that phone bank, send checks, send money, send your body, do whatever you can. That's what's called democracy and engagement. We need to do that.
All right, Bill.
I agree. I've been making contributions to the Warnock campaign, and I hear you. I think there's a few things here. One is that there is a broader level of strategy that we got to be thinking about that involves how do you take on a right-wing authoritarian mass movement? And that's different than what do you do in an election campaign.
Right.
Not that one is more important than the other. They're just very distinct. And so what this moment calls us to do is to engage in a discussion, a very broad discussion among progressive forces about how to fight the right-wing authoritarian movement at all levels, legislative, courts, as well as mass struggles, as well as issues of self-defense. When you were saying, Ron, about black folks being scared, we're not scared in the abstract. I mean, you know, people are definitely thinking about things like Tulsa, Wilmington in 1898, and other situations,
yes.
Right, of actual military action being taken against us. And so we've got to be thinking about how do we build an anti-right-wing movement. And that really means, among other things, that organizations are going to have to move off their mountaintops, as I've been saying. They've got to move into unsafe areas where they're engaging with a broader constituency, as well as when we're thinking about strategy. It can't be strategy just based in safe spaces. We have to go into places where the Republicans exist. We're going to have to go into Kansas. We're going to have to go into other places where you wouldn't necessarily expect a progressive response, but where, interestingly, some of these progressive responses emerge. And so I think that's what faces us. And that discussion, that discussion needs to be at the level of strategy and tactics.
Yes.
You know, yeah, and I really want to tease that part of it out a little bit, because there's a lot of emphasis still on the suburban voters, which I'm sure are crucial, because one of the things that I looked at, and I was getting sick. I said, how is it possible that so-called independents, who are sort of the ones who supposedly think about these issues and go back and forth, how could they possibly support this MAGAism and all of its ugliness and moral bankruptcy. I would just be befuddled. And of course, at the end of the day, that vote broke decisively against MAGAism, which is, you know, critically important. But I think this movement building thing, Bill, that you talked about is the thing that, you know, and we've all talked about this, is that, you know, can't be just an election time, man. We got to, you know, it's got to be a broader strategy. And I think there's a way in which we have yet to really fully sort of bring on board what I would call this people of color, black and people of color centered rainbow in this regard. That while, yes, pursuing white working class voters is something that is important and should be done, I think there's a bigger dividend to be paid deepening the literally hundreds of thousands of black and Latino and Asian, maybe not so much Asian, but who are yet to register and yet to get involved in the political process or in the electoral political process, and will not do so unless we do something different. I mean, it just can't come at election time. We got to figure out ways to address issues and build movements and deal around issues between elections and all of those kind of things. Because I was on a program the other day, and it actually was Dr. M.T. and Tak Sandika, who was giving an assessment for the Pan-African Unity Dialogue. And he was saying, you know, the black vote held, and he went down, and he talked about, you know, 80, I think he said it was 83%, I think, of the black vote. And I said, okay. Then I said, well, yeah, 83%, but that's slippage. Because traditionally, when we've talked about support for the Democratic Party, and it was not just support blindly, it was based on a sense of this is the party that is, you know, it was more in the 90 to 95% range. And all the Republicans need is a sliver. They don't need the majority of the black vote or the majority of the Latino vote or whatever. They only need 5, 6, 7% added on to these cultists. And they will be, that authoritarian piece will be in charge. And in that regard, you know, I think concerns about, you know, you have black men, you know, didn't go in ways, but still a disturbing number of black men who somehow still have reasons why they feel they ought to vote for these MAGA folks. Some of it has to do with business and so forth. And Roland Martin pointed out, well, they ain't none of these MAGA people talking about investing in black businesses or small businesses. So I guess these are some of the areas I would like us to tease out a bit in terms of how we sort of build out this coalition.
Well, you know what, Ron, let's flip the script a little bit for a minute. You know, you just mentioned the African-American vote appeared to be down, you know, from typically 90, 91, 92% for the Democrats. Now, you know, the mid 80s. I think you also said to the effect that we can peel off some, you know, or no, they're peeling off. I'm sorry. They are peeling off some African-American votes. They being, of course, the GOP. How about flipping the script? How about how can we, and this tracks back to what Bill was saying, I think the challenge is peeling off some of them, some of that typically support that they get. What are we talking about? Less educated, white, rural, blue collar, that live in certain areas, suburbs, exurbs, and other places. You know, there's a chance to peel off some of them. It works both ways, and there's a way to do it. Let me just cite one example, Karen. Karen did something very interesting in L.A. in the mayor's race. She built a tremendous coalition here. I mean, second to none, had all the elements in place. Any ethnic group, any demographic group, any economic group, any, of course, labor group you can think of, Karen had on board. She also did something else. She went in, Bill, to parts of L.A. look like Alabama, too. It's not all, you know, sunshine, liberal, Democrat. No, quite the contrary. She went into those areas, and she spent time there. And what she did, she had town halls, and she had forums. She talked about things that they are interested in, public safety, crime. But she did it in a way not pandering. And she talked about jobs. She messaged very well. And I watched her campaign, and I said, you know, she's actually touching all the bases when we talk about coalition building, when we talk about strategizing, crossing over, breaking down some of the barriers. So I'm hoping that people look at what she did in that campaign in the Democratic Party, because I think it has great value. And also, Bill and Ron, she never, ever abandoned her progressive politics at any point. There were many times she could have buck danced, but she didn't do that. So, again, you can actually be a progressive, pragmatic, talk to that other side. You know, you're not going to win all of them over, but you can get some of them thinking, and I think we have some good models to build on. She wasn't the only one. There were other Democrats that did the same thing.
Mm. Okay,
let me add to this. I think that one of the problems when we look at demographics in terms of ethnicity and race is that it obscures politics and it obscures class and gender. And I think one of the challenges that we're facing in Black America, and that's come up in connection with the MAGA movement, is a combination of issues around sexism,
mm-hmm.
class aspirations, and nativism.
Nativism, that's right.
Right, and I'm particularly thinking, Ron, as you know, about groups like American Descendants of Slavery, and groups like that have been anti-immigrant and have been and seem to be, I don't know who is sponsoring them, I can guess, but seem to be definitely influenced by the MAGA crowd, right? So you've got an element, and we've always had a reactionary element within right. Black America, but it's always been eclipsed by the progressive forces. But it's been there. It's like roaches in the kitchen at night, right? And you know that they're there, and you see them when you turn the lights on, right? So that's part of what we're dealing with, and we've got to be real about this. Other thing is that I want to slightly disagree with you, Ron, but only slightly. See, I think we need a white worker strategy. And I think that that part of what's happened in this neoliberal era is that white folks, the American dream has been disappearing for white folks. And in that context, right-wing populism has become a very convenient answer as to why the American dream is disappearing for them. And so I believe that we're in a race against time, actually, with the right-wing populace in order to win, and it relates to what you were saying, Earl, to win a significant segment, at least of white workers, away from right-wing authoritarianism. And so part of that job comes down to unions, but part of it is also the work of groups like, there's this thing called the Rural Organizing Project out in the yes. Pacific Northwest. Right. Groups like that are really going into largely white areas, white rural areas, but we also need to be organizing in Black rural areas and not simply in the cities. So I think that all of this calls for a rethinking of strategy.
Right. Yeah, and I don't think we, I mean, I really actually agree. I just think in some ways there's been an overemphasis on, but actually in some ways not putting the boots on the ground and figuring out who should do that piece of work,
yes.
you know, in terms of white workers, because I think getting a percentage of, and I think there's some real grievances and some real issues in it that could be uplifted. And I think back on the Jackson campaign, and quite frankly, needs to be revisited. He was a genius, frankly, at articulating what was going on in America in relationship to the whole issue of conglomerization and the shifting of jobs and disinvestment in whatever way, and articulating ways in which they ought to be addressed, and I think could have been effective. Unfortunately, there was the demise of the rainbow, and we never really got a chance to test it out in its fullest possibilities. So I think I actually agree with you. I just also fundamentally, though, have this formula, particularly for the Black, and I'll continue to pound on it. If we could get 90% of African Americans, Black voters, registered, and if on election mm-hmm. day we can get 90% of them out, which is really a dream, we would exercise power disproportionate to our numbers. And I still contend, as Reverend Jackson would say, there's still a whole lot of rocks still laying on the ground, even though that, you know, we came to the rescue. There's more to be done, but it cannot be done simply by just, you know, talking about it and not get having a kind of participatory engagement with people on the ground in a way that I don't think the Democratic Party is. There's a consultant-led movement, man. They're lazy, man. It's a probable voter yeah. model when we're looking at the improbable voter, not the probable voter, is sort of the formula. Last words, last quickie from both you, Earl, and you, Bill, as we conclude. I got to go on and talk about the State of the Black World Conference in a little bit. So give me your final thoughts.
Bill?
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Earl. I'll follow.
Well, you know, just to circle back again on, you know, what started all of this. You know, I think we do have challenges going forward to 2023, 2024. Media is not going to change. We can't rely on them. They're still going to be doing what they do, mainly pushing the GOP line. You don't need polls for that. That's just where they are. So we just have to message. I think, Ron, you're big on that. I'm big on that. Bill, you're big on that. Messaging correctly. You know, Biden's done some very significant things, legislative-wise. Many other Democrats have, too. We got to do a better job on selling that. You're the GOP this. They keep everything simple at the second grade, and they know how to message. We got to do the same thing in the right way. I think the third thing, Bill, you're absolutely right. I still think we're going to have to peel off, whether we like it or not, a small percentage of that base over there, the mega base. We got to do that because they vote and we need them. And I think they can be done. I think they're vulnerable. You know, I'm surprised, Ron and Bill, you didn't mention, you talked about Jesse. Did you forget about Bernie Sanders? Bernie went to Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. He went to Michigan. He went to Pennsylvania. He did quite well with that bunch because he understood how to message and he touched the nerve. So I think that model is still there. So I think, you know, the challenge is there. But the good thing about it is I think there's a lot of good things we can learn from 2022 that I think can be applied to 2024.
All right, Bill.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that progressives, first of all, need to study the strategies of the right. And that part of what we have to do is to derail their strategies. That if you defeat their strategies, you defeat them. And sometimes that means going head-to-head, and sometimes it means doing something else. So part of what we have to do is that. Second thing is that we need to build a broad front to oppose the right. And that means that we've got to get beyond purist politics. It means that we've got to identify what kind of operational unity we need in order to do this. And it needs to be at multiple levels where organizations, social groups, et cetera, feel like they're part of that common front. And in doing that, I think that we can beat these people back. But the third thing is represented by the more progressive folks that ran in this election is that you need an alternative. You can't be running on the idea of the status quo. We're not defending. We progressives should not be defending the status quo. We should be defending democracy. But we should also be calling for an expansion of democracy and an alternative approach to economics, climate, et cetera. Right. Those things are going to be what will inspire people to come forward.
Right. I like that. And back in the day, we used to call it the politics of social transformation.
That's right.
Trying to reinvigorate some of those terms. Well, this is my dream team. Earl Ofari Hutchinson. Earl, give us a quick, you had a new book out, right? Coming out, you getting ready to premiere?
Actually, it was on the midterms. And,
okay.
You know, I'm toying with the idea of going after Trump again. I don't know. We'll see how that shakes out.
All right. Okay. We just wanted to, I know you're getting ready to, I know we've talked about doing a tour you were getting ready to do, and we certainly want to help out in whatever way we can.
Yes.
You build anything coming off, any new publications on your end?
Hopefully the sequel to my novel comes out in March. It's going to be called The Man Who Changed Colors and by Hardball Press. And I hope that people will pick it up. Yeah,
that'll sell just on the face of it.
Hey, messaging is everything.
Double meaning, as you'll see.
Right. All right, Earl LaFari Hutchinson and Bill Fletcher, thank you so much. Really appreciate you being my dream team again here on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Have a good
Pacific
one.
Network.
Take care.
All right. Okay, well, that was really enjoyable. I always enjoy having a conversation with Bill and with Earl. And to be continued, I want to spend now the next few minutes. I actually went longer with them because I think it's so important to get this information out, and they're thought-provoking. Some people would disagree because they are pragmatic and they do believe in electoral politics and they do believe in making critical choices. And I know I have been called everything but a child of God for being able to identify similarly, but I'll continue to defend that position in terms of it's not a purist exercise. There's no such thing as a contradictionless strategy in the middle of a contradiction. We have to figure out ways to not sacrifice our core values, even as we make tough tactical decisions towards our strategic goal. And I've always been a proponent, not always, but for most of my adult life, and a proponent of that, and believe in creating a third force in American politics where we're not really, you know, we have our own independent force that we can develop. Anyway, as I announced at the Institute of the Black World 21st Century's town hall meeting on the assessing the state of the midterm elections on Black American and Pan-African world, and you can still, in case you missed it, you can still go to the IBW website, IBW21.org, IBW21.org. In fact, I'm asking people who within the sound of my voice today, we want to build out a larger, more robust list for you to receive information, because there is an incredible amount of information on the IBW website, the NARC website. NARC is the National African American Reparations Commission, and the Black World Media Network. If you have not tuned in to the Black World Media Network, and we had Don Rojas on a couple of weeks ago, and this is his legacy project, but not just because it's personalized, though that in and of itself is valuable. It is an incredible platform, Black World Media Network. We need you to tune in. The other thing is, all roads lead to Baltimore for State of the Black World Conference 5. And that's April 19th through the 23rd. It will be at the Baltimore Convention Center and the Hilton Inner Harbor Hotels in Baltimore, Maryland. And the Inner Harbor is such a gorgeous, wonderful place to be. There's just so many things to do in the Inner Harbor area of Baltimore. And that's where the State of the Black World Conference will be held. It's beautifully connected. The Hilton Inner Harbor Hotel is connected to the convention center. So you can go out if you want to, but you don't have to, because you can. It's adjacent and connected. This is really a rescheduling of the State of the Black World Conference, because initially we were going to do it, because we typically do State of the Black World Conferences after an election. But because of the crucial nature, and by the way, we would have done it in 2020, but we couldn't because of COVID. And we did not want to do it in November for fear of, you know, we wanted to meet in person, and we did not want to be in a situation where we were asking people to risk their health to come together. So we said, let's postpone it or reschedule it until the spring of 2023. All of this is also connected to the 50th commemoration of the Gary National Black Political Convention, the 50th anniversary of African Liberation Day, 20th anniversary of indeed the founding of IBW itself, as well as, I'm kind of celebrating my birthday too. 80 years of being out here, not all 80 years, but still on this journey, so to speak. We wanted to wrap all of that into it. And hence we moved to Baltimore, April 19th through the 23rd. The theme is Global Africans Rising. Global Africans Rising. Empowerment, Reparations, and Healing. And of course, we think that is a powerful theme. By global Africans, we mean all of us. African Americans and people of African descent, African descendants from Central and South America, African people of African descent in the broader global diaspora, as well as on the African continent. This is truly going to be a State of the Black World Conference. And we really, really want you to be engaged in it. And we're going to be enlisting the support of WBAI and WPFW and other outlets, WURD in Philadelphia, our media partners and allies, to be a part of the organizing process. Now, the conference is really, really one that you don't want to miss. We're going to have a Pan-African Institute, which Danny Glover always is the honorary chair of the Pan-African Institute, focusing on issues of democracy and development in Africa, the Caribbean, and Central and South America. There will be at least two major town hall meetings. One will be the State of Black America in the Pan-African World after about 100 days of the new Congress, if you will. And then there's going to be a huge state of the town hall meeting on the state of the global reparations movement. And in that regard, you know, we are inviting to be a part of that town hall meeting. I just got back from Colombia, and we're 99% sure that Francia Marquez, the new vice president of Colombia, will be coming. We're looking for Maya Moore Motley, the first black woman prime minister of Barbados, who is taking a leading role in the reparations movement, to come. And we're also hoping to get Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo from Ghana, who issued recently a very powerful statement, to be here as well. In addition, we are going to have incorporated into the State of the Black World Conference a tribute to Maurice Bishop, who was, of course, the leader, the prime minister of the People's Revolutionary Government of Grenada. There is a new prime minister in Grenada, the Honorable Deacon Mitchell, who is the prime minister. We're going to be inviting him to come and do a tribute and to have him come and be as well. And, you know, we're also inviting people like the longest serving prime minister in the Caribbean, global statesman, Mr. Patterson. We're going to be asking him to come and be a part of the State of the Black World Conference, as well as being the global statesman that he is. So it is really, 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 again, going to be an amazing conference. And by that, I mean P.J. Patterson, the former prime minister of Jamaica and global statesman. We're going to be honoring some people. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the first woman prime minister of Liberia. Akon, the Sinhalese American global singer, songwriter, and record producer, will also be there. So we're really, really, this is the crown jewel of State of the Black World Conferences. So what do we need? And the sessions, I mean, you know, shortly we'll have something out that sort of shows you all the people we're going to be inviting. I mean, this is all just an incredible number of people. I just touched on the town hall meetings, but we're going to have sessions on culture, religion, spirituality, and liberation, environmental justice, climate change, and water as a human right, displacing black people and culture, gentrification as a state of emergency in black America, socially responsible black business and economic development, combating gun violence and murders, fratricides in black communities, a public health crisis, reimagining public safety and law enforcement, and of course, building the U.S. and global reparations movements. We're all going to have some special sessions. We're going to have a global black leadership summit, a global black women's leadership breakfast. We're going to have a global meeting of black mayors and elected officials. We're going to have a special session on Haiti and a special session on the Black World Media Network. Well, what we want to do is enlist your support in this regard to be a part of the overall process. So we're asking people really to go to the website, the sign up location for this proposition, and to go, you will go to IBW21/SOWCB. That is once again, go to IBW21/SOWCB. And there you have an opportunity to sign up. We want people to be advocates and friends, friends and advocates for IBW for State of the Blackwell Conference. Once again, all roads leading to Baltimore for the State of the Blackwell Conference in April. And if you go to the website, you'll be able to see a special message that I've issued. You can play that, and we want to enlist your support in helping us to make it happen. All right, this is the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels. Hope you've enjoyed this edition of Vantage Point, and we'll see you again here next week here on WBAI 99.5 FM. Smiles and making.